Welcome to Local Talk Wednesday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. Your hosts for today are Susan Franzen and Gina McAndrews. Welcome to both of you.
And a special welcome to Gina, who's been in Colorado helping her parents farm and celebrating her father's 90th birthday. Did you have any adventures when you were gone?
Well, not too many major adventures. I didn't get any speeding tickets on the way there out, so that was a big plus. And we had a really nice time for my dad's birthday. We went out to eat two or three times, so he got two or three free desserts, and we sang to him. And other than that, we just checked the cows, and they got 2 foot of snow a couple weeks ago, so it's still pretty muddy and everything out there, and the cows didn't like that too much, but it's pretty much drying up. There's little ponds here and there. And then we have Easter on Sunday, and then I had to make a mad dash back to Iowa, back to Ames. It was great.
Welcome back. Glad you made it back safely. We'll be talking about safety at the end of the program, but we're leading off with a report from Betty Andrews, who has been our guest several times representing the Iowa-Nebraska NAACP and the struggle for restoration of voting rights. But Betty is an activist in several other organizations, so we invited her to bring us a monthly report. Welcome, Betty. We're looking forward to what you have to tell us.
Good morning, Susan. Good morning, Gina. So happy to be with you once again. Thanks so much for having me. And yes, as you know, I'm definitely a strong supporter and actually president of the Iowa-Nebraska NAACP. And I do a number of other things, and I know in the coming months we'll be talking a bit more about those. But I did want to talk a little bit more about the NAACP today, and I actually brought a guest with me today. The NAACP has been involved over the last couple of months since we talked in a number of things in terms of dealing with all of the bills that are coming through the legislature. Many we oppose, and a few that are have been good for Iowa. And then also, just in another organization, we hosted Iowa's African American Festival with I'll Make Me a World in Iowa. And we continue with the NAACP to be involved in some activity that's coming through the courts, as well as working within our community to make Iowa a better place. One of the things that I haven't talked about as much is the topic that is on everyone's mind and continues to be on everyone's mind for the last year, and that's COVID-19. And so I'm happy to have with me today a special guest, and her name is Jackie Easley-McGee, and Jackie is the chairperson for the Iowa-Nebraska NAACP Health Committee. And when I say she is a warrior for making sure that people are informed and take action when it comes to health in general, but specifically over the last year and quite strongly COVID. And so she has been a commentator on a number of programs in a number of community events and has organized various vaccine drives and a number of other things when it comes to COVID. So we're really proud to have her as a part of our team representing us both here in the state of Iowa and on many national forums. So just going to ask Jackie Easley to come forward and give us a report about COVID-19 and all the work that she and I and the NAACP have been doing around COVID. So Jackie, Iowa-Nebraska NAACP Health Chair, thank you and welcome to the program. I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Betty. And it's really wonderful to be here. And I feel like I'm back at home with an Ames audience, my birthplace. I'm so delighted to be speaking to an audience in Ames. One of the reasons that I am so privileged to be serving in this role with the NAACP is that our legacy of really vigilance on national and local issues as it affects communities of color, but particularly African Americans. And just to set the stage, the NAACP, of course, is the largest and the oldest, the baddest and the boldest, the most loved and the most hated, the most feared and the most revered, the most cussed and the most discussed civil rights organization in America. And so in 2020, in the midst of the pandemic crisis, this crisis ripped the Band-Aid off long festering wounds of inequality in many aspects of society, but particularly in healthcare. And the crisis really elevated for us some of the topics that have been discussed in really many scholarly works, including 1619 Project, which some of you may know was authored by Iowa's own Hannah Nicole Jones. And in those works, in her series of articles, she discussed the consequences of slavery and its impact on all aspects of society today. We in healthcare, and by the way, I am a healthcare professional, and in my professional role, I serve as health equity officer for a major healthcare provider here in Iowa. So I too have seen throughout my career really all of these health measure outcome gaps. But it was in 2020 with a pandemic and the disproportionate effect that it had on African Americans and other minorities that highlighted what the 1619 Project has often pointed out have been the really unethical and egregious treatment of African Americans during this country's history. And you have to wonder, if you do a deep dive here in, nationally and here in Iowa, the numbers of African Americans who became afflicted with the coronavirus represented as many as 1.8 times the number of the population of our state, or of African Americans in our state, as compared to the Caucasian and white population. So why is it that we have been really the most impacted by this really dreadful and awful disease? Again, doing the deep dive, you look at many factors that we call social determinants of health, such as our physical environment, such as where we work. And of course, many African Americans work in what we at that time began calling essential frontline work. We were the ones who worked in the manufacturing plants. We were the ones who worked in public positions, public facing positions, such as bus drivers, grocery store clerks, and even in healthcare, we were often the aides, the nurses' aides in long-term nursing facilities, which we all know really bore the brunt of, you know, the coronavirus statistics. So our work, where we live, and then unfortunately a historical trauma and mistrust, as pointed out by Article 1619, of all institutions, but profoundly impacted by health. And so even healthcare, and even going back to 1883, Rebecca Lee Crumpler was the first African-American physician in this country who originally pointed out, very interesting, that there was this disparity of disease in the Black community. And she said, I quote, "They seem to forget," and I believe she was referring to her colleagues in the medical profession, "they seem to forget that there is a disease for every, there is a cause for every ailment, and that it may be in their power to remove it." And so if you look further into history, you land on the Tuskegee, infamous syphilis study in 1940 that after being recruited by the promise of free medical care, African-American men in Macon County, Alabama, were enrolled in this project with armed to study the progression of syphilis. However, none of those individuals were ever treated for the disease. And again, this had a serious impact on the health of those individuals. And this experiment lasted from the mid-1940s through 1972 until a reporter exposed its unethical treatment and effects. And now even further, we look to Henrietta Lacks, who was a African-American woman who was suffering from cervical cancer, and unknown to she or her heirs, her cells, after she succumbed to the disease, were used for research and treatment. Now, of course, there was a benefit to science that these cells, and we've since known that there has been a positive benefit, but again, it's another example of experimentation on African Americans without, you know, involuntarily, without permission. And even as recently as 2013, an investigation found that 148 inmates in a California prison were sterilized, female inmates obviously, were sterilized between 2006 and 2010, many of whom were coerced into the procedure with the really ill-advised treatment that they would be receiving, that they would have better health outcomes as a measure of that. So then it is not surprising, knowing this historical trauma, that African Americans have had this mistrust. And as we now look at the stage that with a vaccine rollout, that in November of 2020, the NAACP conducted a study with the Pew Research Center and found that 53% of African Americans said that they were unlikely to take the vaccine. And so for that reason, many of us, as Betty has pointed out, have spent this entire year working to build what we call trusted messengers in our community, knowing that we would have to counter the historical mistrust, the high impact on our community of the virus, and all of these other social determinants of health to really help and bring awareness and attention to the mitigation. First, it was the mitigation strategies of the virus. And now as we are into the vaccine, working to really help people. And even here in Iowa, as recently as 2-3 weeks ago, only 1% of African Americans in Iowa had been vaccinated. So those are things that we're working really hard to provide awareness, education, help with access, and providing trusted messengers to really turn those statistics around.
Well, Jackie, the trusted messengers are extremely important in our community. You know, quite frankly, it helps when you have someone you know or someone who has a familiar background to be able to tell you that this is okay. It's okay to step into this. And I know we just have a couple more minutes, but I wanted to give you the opportunity to talk about some of the steps that we've taken as the NAACP initially. I know you'll have the details on the letter that we sent to the governor, and also the town hall that we've participated in, as well as a recent vaccine clinic that was held. People are being held across the state, not just in the highlight. Mm-hmm.
So you are absolutely right, Betty. And in the early stages of the virus, as we heard the national statistics related to African Americans who were disproportionately afflicted with COVID, we too were looking to our state to provide similar statistics. And as you know, the governor would have a press conference every week, but those statistics were not being made available to us. And so you as president of the Iowa-Nebraska branch and I as chair sent a letter to the governor asking, could we please have that type of information so we too could begin this strategy of how to mitigate in our own community and provide this messaging. And so, Betty, we were certainly happy about a week later after our letter was delivered that the statistics began to be provided on the Iowa Department of Public Health, and it is still there on their coronavirus website. And so why that was important is then, as you said, we began having, along with our national NAACP and the resources that they have available, having town halls where we could talk about the mitigation that we wanted to really make our community aware of. And then as we moved into the vaccine rollout, even at the African American Festival, I'll Make Me a World in Iowa, we had another panel discussion where we had testimony from our community who, number one, individuals who participated in the clinical trials, and we had a physician from California who shared with us his really passionate outreach to South Central Los Angeles, which is predominantly African American and Latino, and how he was able to successfully deploy the vaccine in his community. So working together as the NAACP with the resources, with the advocacy of our organization, we did help hold a very successful clinic in Des Moines on March 27th, where 1,113 individuals were vaccinated that day. So we believe that all of these efforts have been strategic in helping to provide awareness education.
Okay, I was just going to say that I absolutely agree. And I also know just yesterday, our Cedar Rapids branch held a major vaccine clinic as well. And I know they have another one scheduled for Friday. And so our branches around the state, those are just a couple of examples, are really on making sure we address vaccine hesitancy in our community. Susan or Gina, did you have questions for Jackie?
I don't really have any questions. The extent of this is actually eye-opening to me. I knew about the Tuskegee study, of course. But now, was the governor, did she give you the information that you needed? And was she really
helpful? Yes, after we wrote the letter, yes. And the stats are available even today. And that's how we know how many African Americans have been vaccinated, because they are providing that information.
And, you know, you mentioned the Tuskegee piece that, you know, it is a longstanding piece just because of these historical facts, actually, and others. I mean, there's this whole thing called oppression and a long history and legacy of keeping our knee as American, keeping America's knee on the neck of African Americans. So there has been a natural distrust. And so as Jackie emphasized, the goal, because this is affecting the health of the African American community, as well as other minorities, as well as the general population, the goal was to ensure that people had these trusted messengers in order to make sure that we could help combat this disease. And so I'm pleased to say that, you know, even at the clinic, now I did have COVID earlier, actually December into January, but I still have taken my shot at the clinic that Jackie mentioned, and will be taking my next shot on the 17th. So and I know that the dynamic of working within the community, working with our ministers, working, as Jackie said, with our festivals, our events, and and being already penetrated within the community to be able to deliver this message has been extremely important. So if you don't have any additional questions.
I have one other thing I wanted to add.
Sure.
Recently I've been asked, so post-COVID, and that is not a term that is really in my vocabulary. We are excited that if we do reach herd immunity, and I know you've heard that word, where we want to have at least 75-80% of our population vaccinated, but we certainly still have to practice wearing the face mask and physical distancing, you know, until we achieve that. But for me, the message of this entire crisis has been the health inequities. And by the way, this is Public Health Week, so I feel like I have to advocate for my colleagues who work diligently day in and day out to talk about the effects of long-term and chronic illness. And the reason that African Americans were disproportionately impacted were because of diabetes and COPD and heart and lung disease that we suffer at a disproportionate rate. So I would be less than honest to our profession if I did not say the long-term effect of the crisis is that we are really going to have to be focused in and vigilant about these chronic illnesses and the disproportionate impact of our community. And health equity is the goal that we need to really strive for.
Thank you, Jackie. And thank you, Susan and Gina, for having us.
Thank you so much.
In case you just tuned in, Betty Andrews has been with us for an Iowa Black Community Report. Betty represents our growing effort to live up to the name Diversity Radio. But we haven't lost interest in the activities going on in the small towns of our listening area. Now that we're both vaccinated, Paul Wearson and I celebrated by taking our first road trip in over a year. We met at the office of the Greater Chamber Connection in Story City with the new director, Shannon McKinley. Let's listen in.
Paul Wearson and Susan Franson were on our first road trip during the pandemic, and we're up in Story City, Iowa, and we're starting to look at summer and some of the events that are going to be going on as we get to the latter part of the pandemic. We can't say that the pandemic is over, but things are looking up in terms of what we expect for the summer. And we're talking to Shannon McKinley, who is here at the Story City Chamber Connection. And what better expert opinion we could have than Shannon, who's here every day in this marvelous office with all these great old pictures of downtown Story City and all the memorabilia from events past. Welcome to our show today,
Shannon. Thank you for having me.
First thing we have to ask you right off the bat is about Scandinavian Days. That normally happens like the first weekend in June.
Correct.
And now there's a change, so tell us about that.
There is a change. So we decided to give ourselves a little extra time this year and just make sure that we could get everybody vaccinated and safe. So we moved Scandinavian Days to a one-day event this year, which will be July 24th, and we're putting it in conjunction with National Carousel Day, which is July 25th. So we're merging the two events together this year.
Yeah, and for those who aren't familiar, Story City is all about the carousel. We have this 1913 wonderful antique carousel. And so we're plugged into the National Association of Carousels.
Yep.
And I know they've had meetings here in Story City featuring people from that.
That is correct.
And are there going to be special events in connection with that?
There will be. So the Saturday of Scandinavian Day, we'll focus on Scandinavian Days. There will not be a parade this year, but we are looking at having a craft show. There will be live music in the park. We have three different bands that will be performing that day. The carousel will be open, and then we're looking at a few other park activities during that day. On Sunday, we will have National Carousel Day, which the carousel will be open also in that time frame in the park. So
actually, most of the events will be centered in the park.
Yep, everything will be outdoors and centered at the North Park, kind of between the carousel and the high school will be our main activity area.
Now, this is when you come into Story City. The signage is actually pretty good. If you come in off the interstate,
yep.
You're going to see the marvelous park system mm-hmm. we have in Story City. There's
yep.
a north and a south park.
Yep.
And the south park features the famous swinging bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And the north park has the carousel. And both parks have extensive facilities and space. So is there going to be a carnival or anything like that?
There will not be a carnival this year, partially because the North Park is actually going to go under a playground renovation this year, so that is exciting. We're looking to expand some of our playground offerings, and if anybody's ever visited our North Park, there is the S table. Added to the S table this year will be a C table, so it'll be an SC table for Story City. So that'll be an exciting addition to the town.
Well, the S table is made out of cement,
mm-hmm.
and it is in the shape of an S, and the seats are also constructed out of cement. And I actually have a picture of my mother and her teenage friends sitting at this table in 1924.
Oh, nice.
So this goes way back,
uh-huh.
and so I'm glad and excited to hear that you're going to augment that.
Yep.
Story City really has a great park system. Now, people are going to miss the parade because that's the big event usually at 10 o'clock on Sunday, and that means that there won't be Tootsie Rolls flying through the air or anything like
that. There won't be, and that is due to a couple of different things. Partially because there will be road construction on Broad Street this year. So we are starting a 3-year project of some road construction on Broad and decided to not, with the pandemic and the construction, to not have the parade this year. So we'll look forward to having the parade come back in 2022.
Well, you know, you've already got a lot of good events coming to the park, and I'm excited to hear that you have live bands.
Mm-hmm.
And there'll probably be a beer garden too, is that?
There won't be a beer garden. It will just kind of be more of a art in the park kind of feel with live music. So pull up your chair, listen to some music, and then we'll end that Saturday night with an amazing 10 o'clock fireworks show.
Yeah, fireworks are immune to the pandemic.
That is true.
That's something you can do without any problem.
That
is happens
true.
Way overhead.
Yeah.
And you know, one charming thing in the North Park is the old bandstand,
mm-hmm.
and that's really a fully powered electric.
Yep, and that is where all the bands will be performing.
Yeah, it's a natural, and then
yep.
there's a natural hill, sort of an amphitheater effect where people can sit in lawn chairs. And
yep, so we'll have food vendors right there, and we'll have the craft show right there, so if you can listen to the music and shop around and get yourself a treat from one of our service organizations in town and support them also.
Well, it's going to be exciting because you're still going to do Scandinavian Days, although it'll be on July 24th.
Yep.
And the essence of it is the park. And
yep.
very often during Scandinavian Days, apart from the parade and Heritage Hall and some of these things that are downtown, actually Scandinavian Days largely takes place in the park anyway.
Correct.
So
yep.
that's not really going to be an issue. And I look forward to that.
Yep.
And you've been creative in doing an alternative here. And then it fits in, too, with the construction projects and things going on.
Yep.
That's probably a time to talk about what else might be happening this summer in Story City.
Okay. So we're going to kick off our next event in downtown will be on May 1st, which we are partnering with the Live Healthy Iowa out of Ames, which we will be a host site for the 5K. So that'll be on May 1st. It'll run the course through our downtown. With that also, we're looking at bringing the duck race back this year in June.
Oh, yeah, the duck race. Yeah.
The duck race, yes. So looking for that to be the end of June. Details will come. We're meeting tomorrow to kind of finish out the planning on that. Also looking at our Story City GCC golf tournament, which usually happens in August. And then we're already planning for downtown trick-or-treat and touch a truck for kids come in October. So.
Well, you know, the 5K, I'd have no trouble socially distancing because I'd be so far behind.
Right.
I probably won't do it. My knee is bothering me,
yeah.
so I won't be in the 5K. But I hope a lot of other people will be. And I'm anxious to hear also what you think about the after fall. And, you know, you have that. Thanks. Well, you have the trick-or-treat events
mm-hmm.
that are associated with that.
Yep.
And do you think we're going to be back to a normal schedule by the time you get to Christmas activities?
Everything we hear just says that fall will be when, in tourism aspect, they're saying fall is going to be when everything will kind of be back to a new normal, as they're putting it. You know, it's going to take us a while to get back pre-pandemic, but they're looking at seeing everything come fall to be a little more open. People feel more comfortable coming to events and things like that. So.
Well, I attended a Rolling Store track meet last Thursday, and it was outdoors. It was a little chilly for the kids, but everyone was masked and behaved well. And I happened to do the PA for baseball for the boys, and I anticipate that will be, you know, masked again, but normal. And the concession stands already have the precautions. You have the plexiglass and in the front so that you have all those guards in place. And people do a nice job of alternative planning.
We realized that last year when we opened the carousel. We didn't do it on a daily basis, but we kind of had a limited schedule where we were only open 2 hours, took a break, came back for 2 hours, which worked really well with masks and social distancing on the carousel worked really well. We will still implement that same stuff this year. We're adding a few more hours this year just because things are getting a little better, so we're going to adapt that way. But excited to have the carousel open back up on June 2nd and be open on Wednesday nights from 5 to 7 and welcome everybody. And
that's terrific. You know, last year is the first year I didn't take any carousel rides.
Yeah.
I just thought about that.
No.
That's terrible. I didn't get on the carousel.
Well, you'll have to come back this year and we'll give you a ride.
I will be there if I have to muscle a 9-year-old out.
There you go.
Now, beyond that, how's Main Street looking? I know you're part of the Main Street effort that's around the country, and there are several communities who are part of Main Street. How's that going? How's the Main Street?
You know, the pandemic caused people to shop a little more local, which is good. I hope that people realize to continue to support your local businesses, but that's your floral shop, a restaurant, a pharmacy, whatever that business may look like, your grocery store. You know, support that local because those are the people that were here for you during those pandemic times when you were home, you know, and they've adapted to do curbside and deliveries in that way. So Main Street's looked a lot different this past year as people have tried to adapt to serving the customer more.
Well, I look around to small rural communities surrounding Story City, and Story City is very fortunate to have most of their storefronts occupied.
That is true.
It's a pretty lively downtown, and I hope that continues.
Yeah.
There's always here and there a vacant storefront, but in Story City, they tend to fill up, and there is a lot of traffic. When you come up here during a weekday, plenty of cars parked on Broad Street.
That is true.
And, plenty of room for parking, too. We have these marvelous broad streets. It's well named. This is one of the broadest streets in Iowa. You can park, you can angle park on both sides and still have room for angle parking in the middle and have traffic both ways. That's how broad Street is. And I've always been thrilled about that from my earliest years growing up here. But it's good to hear that the Chamber Connection is doing well. And here in Story City, we have a bowling alley. We have so many things that are really nice to have in a small town. And those are all remaining open and healthy. And we've added some new things in the past few. We have TriStar, a brand new big truck stop out east of town. And so around our interstate exit, very good business opportunities there. And we have some manufacturing here in town. So we have some major employers. And I think Story City is pretty healthy. And I think a lot of that is due to the coordination that happens through this office because you have to have community spirit and people pulling together. And Shannon, you are optimistic, right?
I am, absolutely. It's
going to
be a great 2021.
Well, she's here at the front desk and always smiling and welcoming people in. And it's a very pleasant office. It has pictures of all the things in Story City that are important. There's a big picture of the swinging bridge, which actually was a WPA project in 1936 and suffered some major damage in recent years, and it's all up and running again and beautifully done. And I think that both the North and South Parks are beautiful, and it's nice that we're keeping them up.
That is true.
And so you have a big project in the North Park, and this is Playground.
Yep, Playground, yep.
And there are new bridges, too, across
the bridge. New bridges, and there will be a new walking path on that east side of the North Park. So kind of finishing to get from the west side to the east side of North Park will all be completed and nice by fall.
Yeah, both the North and South Park have a lot of new sidewalk.
That is true.
Which really makes it handicap accessible.
Yep.
I'm impressed by that because it used to be just grass.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine if you can walk and don't have a lot of mobility issues. But now you could drive a wheelchair anywhere in the park and still have access to shelters and all of that.
Yep.
Well, Shannon, it's nice to hear that Scandinavian Days is coming back, even though it's going to be July 24th.
Yep.
Mostly in the park, no parade, but still lots of fun. And we have all the activities coming up in the fall. And before Scandinavian Days, you have all the things that we normally do, like the opening of the carousel and the duck race probably before that, too.
Yep.
So things are happening in Story City. Shannon McKinley can tell you all about it. And please put that in your calendar, July 24th. And come to Story City anytime if you want to shop, have fun. And starting in the summer now, again, the carousel will be open, and that is unique. Shannon, thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
And we appreciate the opportunity to be here. It's a great office, great town, and all of us look forward to a slowdown, at least, and maybe an end of the pandemic by the end of the summer. And I really hope that all the things we're used to will be back in action again in the fall. Thanks, Shannon McKinley.
Thank you.
This is KHOI Community Radio, Story City, Ames. And yesterday, Paul Wearson and I met at the Story City Greater Chamber, where the new director, Shannon McKinney, gave us a preview of the summer events as rearranged by the pandemic.
Sounds like they've had some fun activities, but no Scandinavian Days parade.
And no, I listened to a show in our archives about Scandinavian Days past, and it's really different. But they're doing a great job of celebrating what they have and introducing the great things at the North Park, and people have a good time, and nobody will get indigestion from the Kumla contest. I think this is safety and health seems to be our theme for this week. Our last guest is from the DNR to talk to us about water safety. And of course, this is uppermost in our mind in Ames because of the accident at Little Ball Lake. In spite of that, of course, the weather is such that people are pouring out to get on the water, get in canoes and get in kayaks. And so we have Todd Robertson here from the DNR to talk to us a little about water safety.
Hello, Todd Robertson. Hello, Todd. Thank you for joining us today.
You're very, very welcome. I could talk paddling and paddling safety all day long.
Do you want to tell us a little bit of what you do and when you have these classes?
Sure. Well, I've been with the DNR for about 12 years. Started as a seasonal, but I've always been in the rivers program, so I'm basically the outreach coordinator for river programs, but I am in the communication and education and marketing bureau. But I got certified as a canoe instructor from the American Canoe Association almost as soon as I started with the Iowa DNR, because we needed some certified instructors, because even back then, you know, people were starting to paddle a lot. When I first started paddling 15, 20 years ago, I hardly ever saw anybody out on the river at the same time I was. And that just started changing. But that's what I do at the DNR, is I do a lot of community outreach, a lot of talking to paddlers and some of the outfitters that rent out the boats. And I wear a lot of different hats, let's just put it that way.
Do you think with all the virus and things going on and the warmer weather, are there getting to be a lot more people going out on the water?
Yeah, well, that actually started happening in April of May of 2020, when we were right in the middle or right at the beginning of a lockdown. People were looking for a way to get out of the house and for something halfway safe to do. And they found out that, hey, maybe we could go, we're going to go borrow our friend's kayak or canoes or whatever and go out on the river in really small groups or just, you know, one or two boats. And that actually worked out for people. They got to stay away from everything that was kind of happening and go out and mentally relax. And that really caught fire. Yeah.
That's great. What are some of the regulations that we have in Iowa for kayaking, canoeing, that sort of thing?
Well, the biggest regulation that people need to know about is about life jacket laws. You know, the U.S. Coast Guard recently did a study where 84% of drowning victims were folks that were not wearing life jackets. It's a no-brainer. That's what a life jacket is. It's not a seat cushion. It's not something you throw. It's something that you actually wear. And so it's really important for people to understand that if you're a kid, if you're under the age of 13, so if you're 12 and under, you have to wear that life jacket at all times when your boat's underway and when you're out on the water. If you're above that, so say you're an adult, you've been swimming all your life, you don't feel like wearing a life jacket, we recommend that you always do. But if you don't, one really important regulation to know is that you have to have it on your vessel. So if you're paddling a kayak and you're not wearing your life jacket, you have to have it somewhere on the boat itself. The only problem with that is I've seen people trying to put on life jackets as they're flying down river in the water. And if it wasn't so frightening, it would actually be funny because it is impossible or it takes a long, long time to put a life jacket on when you're actually in the water. So having it on the boat, it's a regulation and you have to do it and it's a great idea. But when you think about it, if that life jacket's not worn, it's really not going to do you any good. So we would just like people to start wearing their life jackets. I don't care if you're Michael Phelps and you've got your gold medals hanging and you can swim in any swimming pool you want. A river and a lake are different environments and you need something to aid you. And that's what a life jacket is for. That's why it's called a life jacket. So make sure the kids are always wearing their life jackets, even if they're just waiting, doing a rock collecting down on the shore of a river. Kids like to walk out into that river, get their feet wet. You know what? It's a great idea to just have the life jackets on them then. Because we've seen people walk out. A river is like a road. It's not totally flat. You'll come across holes and things like that. So you know what? The overall advice when it comes to safety, number one, wear the life jacket. Don't stash it in the boat. Try to wear it.
And are there any other regulations, like they need to have kind of like license plates on their...
So registrations, like kayaks and canoes that are 13 feet or under, do not require registration at this time, okay? Over 13 feet, a lot of the kayaks that are sold out there are around 14 feet. Those do need to be registered. So you can go on the Iowa DNR website and they tell you how to do that. But absolutely. And that, you know what? That goes for paddle boards as well. And that's just something, you know, you don't want to get a fine for that. I mean, there's a reason we do it. So hopefully everybody's on board with that. Make sure you get your boat licensed.
Can you share with us some of the things that you cover in your kayak classes?
Yeah, so in our kayak classes, and we have six this year, a mixture of kayak and canoe classes. Most of these classes are geared towards teaching the naturalist. So we have 99 counties in the state, right? Every county's got a county conservation board. Every county conservation board's got a naturalist or two. Some have three or four. They're the ones that take large groups of the public out on the water for on-the-water events for their CCB. So we do a lot of training them so they can transfer that knowledge and those skills to the people that they actually take out. So we do get other people that take the classes, but we have, I believe it's three canoe classes and two kayak classes this year. Right now we're signing up naturalists, and then those dates are going to go live on the Iowa DNR website probably in the next 24 hours. So there is that opportunity to improve some paddling techniques and safety information, things like that.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
What's some of the best, in your opinion, was some of the best places to go kayaking, canoeing in Iowa?
Well, do you want to just know my favorites?
Sure.
I'll tell you my favorites. One of the first rivers I ever paddled back in the early 2000s was the Middle Raccoon up in Panora. And it's just a beautiful route from Panora down to Redfield. And you can split that trip up in half. And it's just, you don't see any houses. You know, you're still fairly close to Des Moines, but you feel like you're really out there in the woods and on the river in a wild setting. And it's just really pretty up there. The fishing's really good. And there's just a lot of cool scenery. So the Middle Raccoon there, the Middle Raccoon, the South Raccoon over by Stewart, that one doesn't get paddled much. I don't think a lot of people know about that. That's also a beautiful stream. But I'm a big fan of Middle River down in Madison County. You know, you got the covered bridges and you're paddling under them. That's pretty cool. Lizard Creek is a beautiful stream, but it's got a little bit more challenge to it. So you really need to know what you're doing before you hop on Lizard Creek up in Fort Dodge. But the payoff is awesome. It's just a fun little creek. And I've paddled just about every river in the state. I mean, you can go up to the northeast part of the state. That's the part that gets all the glory because they have the huge bluffs on the upper Iowa by Decorah. And it's a great tourist destination. But we have beautiful rivers all over this state. I mean, if you were to look at a map, I think people are surprised by how many flowing rivers we actually have. We're very, very lucky to have this many rivers. And if you look at a map at just central Iowa, Des Moines has their pick of where they want to go paddle. And I like seeing people embrace that. So, yeah, you look hard enough, you're going to find something that's just for you. So, and we do have water trail maps to a lot of these rivers on the Iowa DNR website that you can download, or you can email or call me, and I'll even send you a hard copy. It's really important to know where you're going when you go on these rivers. Where are the accesses? Are there any public restrooms nearby? I mean, if you're planning your day, you need to know about that river and what's on it. So we encourage everybody to get a water trail map and do a little study of it.
Oh, that's great information to know.
Yeah.
And they recently did a little project in Ames, removing the dam or lowering the dam or something, so they have white water. Do you know about that?
On the Skunk, our dam folks, Nate Hogeveen, who's my supervisor, and he's really the leader of the Rivers Program. He's the one that kind of started it. And Glenn Harmon is an environmental specialist who specializes in low-head dam removals and modifications. I'd love to have them here to talk about that because I'm a dummy when it comes to the engineering side. But these guys rock it, I'll tell you. And, yeah, that location in Ames, that's going to be a nice little park and play spot for people that want to learn how to do a little whitewater. You know, it's a little bit of surfing. And then it's also going to have a safe passage. So if you're coming down river and you don't want to go over the whitewater, you have an area where you can go through. And that's just a brilliant idea. And there are a lot of rivers like that that we can do that with. And we have done a lot of low head dam modifications. And I mean, look what they did up in Charles City and Manchester. You have two of the biggest, best whitewater parks in the Midwest right here in Iowa. And the future looks really bright for having a few more of those around this state. So yeah, no shortage of places to go and paddle.
I have a question about the park by the Lowhead Dam that used to be, I guess, in Ames. My recollection was that went through the golf course. Is that?
I have no idea about that, where it goes, actually.
Well, I mean, it wouldn't be a good place for a park, I wouldn't think.
Right. Now, I'm not real super familiar with that spot and with that area, but yeah.
I think it's right there on the north side of 13th Street as you're going to down on that plain where they have the baseball diamonds and the soccer fields and things. There's that park in there.
I actually have never been there, but when my granddaughter was in Campfire Girls, they had somebody who came in and led them on a canoe trip, took them on a canoe trip that went over that. And apparently the person wasn't very well trained because they rolled. It was dangerous. And so that's one of the reasons that I wanted to have Todd here, because I thought there are other dangerous places and people need to be aware.
Yeah, you know, a good mindset for people to get into is, I don't care how good of a paddler you are. I mean, here I'm a certified ACA instructor, and I still swim. I still go into the water. Everybody is really just in between swims. And if we think of it that way, we will dress properly when we go out on the water. What we've got happening right now, you know, if you want to talk about it right now, one of the biggest safety issues I see are people having the spring fidgets for so long, and then we get a beautiful 80-degree day, and people want to hit the water, but they forget that the water's still in the 40s or 50s, and it's different than the air temperature. So if you hit the cold water and you're not prepared for it and you're not wearing the right gear, you're going to have the possibility of suffering something called cold water shock, which is a nasty thing. I don't want to ever see anybody go through that again. So, you know, even right now with the water still really, really cold, wearing a wetsuit is a smart idea. Wearing things that you can get out of once you get wet. People that are going out wearing cotton right now and jean shorts, that's not a smart move. You have to dress for the possibility of going in the water and going for a swim. Cold water shock, if I came up to you guys and poured a glass of ice water down your back, the first thing you do is go, that involuntary gasp reflex. If you do that when you're under the water after you've hit it, you're done. You're done. I mean, you can't breathe underwater. So it makes you want to gasp, and then your blood pressure rises and you start to hyperventilate. You can actually have a heart attack by being in the cold water and not being prepared for it. So dress for the water. Pretend like you're going to dump your boat and you're going to go for a swim, and you'll be a lot safer than if you don't.
Well, that's a great ending. I see we're out of time. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Todd. And hopefully,
thanks for having me on anytime.
Hopefully we'll see you out on the water.
I'll be out there. I want to see you guys out there.
Okay. I got my kayak cleaned up, ready to go.
And check those life jackets, zippers, and buckles. Those life jackets need to be inspected after they've sat around all winter.
Oh, that's a good reminder. I need to do that.
Yeah, yeah. Same thing for your boats. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
See you later. Bye-bye.
Local Talk here on KHOI Community Radio. And your hosts for today have been Gina McAndrews and Susan Franzen. Remember that you can also hear it online at khoifm.org. And the links to today's guests and information you heard during the program will be on the website. Local Talk will be rebroadcast at 7 p.m. today.
Local Talk was engineered by Michael Murphy. Other voices you heard were Betty McAndrews, Paul Wearson,
Jackie Easley McGee,
and Todd Robertson. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! At the top of the hour. Morning masterpieces will follow at 9 a.m.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop, as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, please contact us at 515-292-2878. That's 515-292-2878. Or you can contact us through our website at khoifm.org. That's also what you need to know to contact us if you decide to become a member or if you would like to renew your membership. Just get on our website at khoifm.org and hit the yellow Donate Become a Member button. If you enjoyed the show, please tell your friends. Remember, your participation as a listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.
is Mayor John Hala from Ames. The deaths of Iowa State University Crew Club members Yaakov Ben David and Derek Nanny while practicing rowing at Little Wall Lake on Sunday morning are painful and tragic. The entire Ames community extends its deepest sympathies to their families and friends. We share your sorrow at such a sudden and unexpected loss of life and are devastated by the outcome of this accident. Although I never had the pleasure of meeting either student, I have learned that Yaakov was a sophomore from Washington, D.C., majoring in accounting, and Derek was a freshman chemistry major from Normal, Illinois. They apparently both loved rowing and were enthusiastic participants in the sport. As a community, we welcome students from all over the globe to Ames to attend Iowa State University. As they learn, grow, and develop into future leaders, we hope and aspire for them to find their life's passion and place in the world. We are saddened by this unrealized potential from lives so unexpectedly cut short, and our hearts go out to their families and friends. The Ames City Council and City of Ames staff join the entire Iowa State University family and our own Ames residents in remembering Yaakov Ben David and Derek Nanny.